because I think I might be the only person here who's talking about nothing related to cosmology whatsoever. Instead, the boring and staid subject of quantum black holes. So maybe in recompense for that, I'll try and make my talk as controversial and exciting as possible. Today I'm going to be talking about primarily some work which came out a few months ago with Alejandro Castro, a postdoc at McGill, and Andy Strominger at Harvard. Also at the end, if I have time, I'll try and talk for a few minutes about some work which is forthcoming with an as yet unspecified and possibly empty set of collaborators. Given the nature of the audience, perhaps it would be best for me to begin with a rather general overview. So the problem that I'm going to be trying to address today is whether we can understand the quantum description of realistic, which is to say astrophysical, black holes. So, of course, one of the great successes of string theory has been a microscopic description of certain quantum mechanical black holes. But the best understood and the only precisely understood cases in string theory involve rather special sorts of black holes, namely black holes that are extremal in one sense or another. So the most famous example of quantum black holes in string theory are supersymmetric black holes, which have mass equal to charge as measured with some gauge fields. And of course, in realistic astrophysical black holes, the charge of a black hole is zero or very, very small. So of course, those aren't terribly realistic. And over the last year or two, there's also been considerable progress in understanding extremely rotating Kerr black holes. But an extremal Kerr black hole is one whose mass is equal to the square of its angular momentum. And so that, of course, is also not something that we see for realistic astrophysical black holes. And moreover, the description of only extremal black holes in quantum setting is somewhat disappointing in the sense that extremal black holes all have the very special property that their Hawking temperature is zero. They're exactly stable states. And so in a sense, they're the least interesting sorts of black holes to try and think about quantum mechanically. And so today, I'm going to describe some progress towards addressing the situation. And I'll be considering Kerr black holes with arbitrary mass and angular momentum. So I'm not going to be setting m equals to j squared. And I'll provide what I think is good evidence that the states of the 3 plus 1 dimensional Kerr black hole can be described by a dual conformal field theory. This will be a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And by making what I think are eminently reasonable assumptions about the properties of this conformal field theory, I'll compute the density of states and compare it to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and find that they match, including the precise numerical coefficient. So before delving into details, let me just explain the idea in a bit more detail. So every derivation of the entropy of an extremal black hole in string theory can be thought of in terms of ADS-CFT. And the basic idea of such a derivation is that the near horizon geometry of an extremal black hole includes anti-de Sitter states. And so the states of the near horizon region can be organized in terms of the states of the conformal field theory. And then one can use one's knowledge about conformal field theories to compute the density of states. Now, the problem with non-extremal black holes is that their near horizon geometry is very boring. It's just Minkowski space written in Rindler coordinates. And so we know of no way of associating a conformal field theory with Minkowski space. But what I would like to point out is that if one organizes the computation correctly, you can argue that even though there's no conformal symmetry of the near horizon geometry of the Kerr black hole, the states will nevertheless still organize themselves into representations of the conformal group, and so can still be described by a conformal field theory, even though that conformal symmetry doesn't have a strictly geometric origin. And that's what I'm going to try and describe.
gravity, right?
No, I would argue that the conformal symmetry is crucial, because all of the...
Well, we know examples of field theories with RG, non-trivial RG flows, yes. Equal to gravity theories.
Yes.
Those are not...
But all of the black hole entropy derivations follow essentially from Cardy's formula, which is a property of conformal field theories. Maybe we can... Okay. The point is that there is no decoupling limit in the same sense for a non-extremal black hole. But nevertheless, there still is a conformal field theory. Or at least there's still strong evidence for conformal field theory. Maybe we can defer that to Scott. We'll have that argument when the time comes.
So this theory has gravity in other words, so it doesn't decouple, or it has lots of...
I'm going to remain agnostic on as many properties of the field theory as I can. So I'll need to...
There's one thing I can compute about the field theory, which is its central charge. In order to get the entropy to work out, I need to make certain other assumptions about the theory, which I'll be very precise about. But aside from that, I'd like to remain as agnostic as possible. Okay. So given that the Hilbert space organizes itself in representations of the conformal group, one can then proceed and do the computation exactly as one does for extremal black holes. But as I just mentioned in response to Eva, many of the features of this putative dual conformal field theory remain quite mysterious in ways that I'll try and make precise. So the first thing that I need to do today is describe for you what sector of the theory I'm going to be describing in terms of a conformal field theory. It will not be a near horizon limit, because as we saw, the near horizon limit is rather trivial, but instead it'll just be a near limit, which I'll try and make precise. I'll then describe the conformal structure that appears in this limit, and then use that to count states in the usual ADS-CFT manner. So before doing all that, let me just give you a very brief caricature of the way that the story proceeds for extremal black holes, such as an extremely charged black hole that appears as a supersymmetric state in string theory. So for an extremal black hole, we define the near horizon region to be the set of points in the geometry which are very close to the horizon. And now R minus R horizon has dimensions of length. So when we say that's very small, we mean very small compared to any rate curvature length scale associated with the curvature of the black hole. So for example, we mean very small compared to the mass of the black hole. I'm using here units where Newton's constant is equal to 1, so mass has units of length. And in all of the extremal black holes that people consider, the near horizon geometry includes an ADS factor. And the isometry group of anti-de Sitter space, the group of geometric symmetries of anti-de Sitter space, is the same as the conformal group in one less dimension. That is the basic observation that's the starting point for ADS-CFT. And one can refine that observation a little bit by noting that if you look at how the isometries of anti-de Sitter space act on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, they act as conformal transitions. So the set of symmetries of the near horizon geometry of an extremal black hole acts as conformal transformations on the boundary of the near horizon geometry. So if one were to try and describe the states of that near horizon theory, you would describe them as states of a conformal theory, and in particular of a conformal field theory. And this really goes back to work that Brown and Hanau did 25 years ago, in the context of three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, which is described by a two-dimensional conformal field theory. But it was really made much more explicit by Maldacena and many other people, some of whom are in this room, over the last decade. Now, a non-extremal black hole is unstable. But the point that I would like to make is that this does not preclude a CFT description of the state. It just means that there's no decoupling limit between the modes that describe the near horizon geometry and the modes far from the black hole. So if there is a CFT description, which I'll argue that there is, then that CFT must be coupled to the external degrees of freedom. So we then need to ask, what is the analog of the near horizon region for a non-extremal black hole? So let's think a little bit more precisely about what we meant by the near horizon region of an extremal black hole. Well, I said that we were looking at the part of the geometry which is very close to the horizon of the black hole as measured by the length scale set by the curvature radius of the black hole. Now, for any extremal black hole, there's a double pole of the horizon, which means that if you looked at the radial gravitational potential as a function of radius, it would have a minimum at the horizon. So that means that saying that you're near the horizon is the same thing as saying that you're probing the geometry by very low energy modes, because a very low energy mode will have to be localized near the minimum of that potential, which is at the horizon. So there's two different ways that you could phrase the statement that you're making a near horizon limit of a extremal black hole. You could either say you're zooming in on the horizon region, or you could say you're probing the black hole by low energy modes. And by low energy, I mean that the frequency is much smaller than the inverse length scale set by the curvature of the geometry. Now, when I said earlier that the near horizon geometry of a non-extremal black hole was boring, I was using that first definition of the near horizon geometry. But for a near horizon geometry, we no longer have a double pole at the horizon. So these two definitions of near horizon no longer coincide. So what I would like to do today is, instead of looking at this boring near horizon region, which just gives me Rindler space, I would like to look at this second definition of the near horizon region, because those two definitions don't coincide for a non-extremal black hole. Yeah.
Okay, flat black holes,
yes.
Not black. So low frequency could involve very long wavelengths out near infinity.
I'm going to address that on the next slide.
I mean, there's also a big class of non-extremal black holes, which in the near horizon limit you don't get GTC, you don't get Rindler. Basically, all the five-dimensional non-extremal ones in the near horizon limit are non-extremal GTCs. So. It's sort of arbitrary non-extremal.
Yeah, you know, there are, I mean, they all are extremal in the sense that you have a double pole of the horizon.
No, this is completely non-extremal. Just arbitrary charges. Just take five-dimensional, non-extremal charge black hole.
Okay,
and charges.
Just, maybe we can discuss that afterwards. I'm going to try and focus on four-dimensional black holes.
There actually have been some follow-up papers written on five-dimensional black holes as well. Maybe we can let's discuss that afterwards. I think that let's discuss that afterwards. Okay. So what I would like to do is probe a non-extremal black hole by a very low energy mode. And I would like to ask what sort of, not near horizon, but what sort of near to the black hole limit I can define in terms of such probes. Now, as Gary pointed out, these modes don't live near the horizon in any sense. But if I'm choosing to probe a black hole by a very low energy mode, then I can define a near region to the black hole, which will be the analog of the near horizon regime for an extremal black hole, just by saying I focus on the region of the geometry that is close to the center of the black hole, as defined by the length scale set by this frequency. And this is what I mean by the near region of the black hole. And the point is that this definition is probe dependent. So it depends on the choice of energy, omega, that I'm using to probe the black hole. In particular, when omega is very small, it will include not just the horizon of the black hole, but regions outside the horizon of the black hole. And it doesn't include just the outer horizon, because these are Kerr black holes with an inner and outer horizon, but it rather includes both horizons, as well as, for example, the ergosphere of the black hole, which is outside the black hole, and in principle points, which could be even far outside the ergosphere if omega is very small. So just to recapitulate, this definition of the near region is a probe-dependent definition. And so there's no sense in which it's strictly a limit of the geometry. And that's a reflection of the fact that there's no strict decoupling between modes near the horizon and modes far from the horizon. Let me make that statement a little bit more precise. So I've defined the near region as the set of points which are close to the black hole as measured with respect to the length scale set by this probe. But I could also define the set of points which are far from the black hole in the sense that they're the set of points where the metric approaches Minkowski space. And that would just be the set of points where the radius is much larger than the curvature, the radius of curvature of the black hole. So R much larger than M. And that's what I would call the far region. And the point is that because I'm probing the black hole with a very low energy mode, those two regions overlap. In particular, if we wanted to, for example, study the evolution of modes in this black hole background, then we could do that in an approximation scheme where we solve the wave equation in the near region, we solve it in the far region, and we match together along some matching surface, which is in this region where both the near and the far region overlap. And indeed, if you look in Chandrasekhar's book or in the original papers of Press and Tukulski, I always forget how to pronounce his name. Did I get it right? Tukulski? Press and Tukulski. Indeed, they describe such approximate solutions to the wave equation found by matching together the near and the far regions. And the point is that this matching surface plays the same role in what I'll describe as the boundary of anti-de Sitter space plays in the extremal case. So, in particular, the claim is that physics in the near region will have a conformal symmetry. And just as in ADS, the conformal symmetry is realized as a conformal transformation of the boundary, here the conformal symmetry of the near region will be realized as a conformal transformation of the matching surface. It's at finite radius.
So the conformal transformation, the scale transformation moves it.
Unlike
the boundary of ADS.
Absolutely. So that's a sense in which you might expect that this conformal field theory is not completely decoupled from gravity. In the sense that you said, because it's not at infinite distance in the same sense that the asymptotic ADS boundary is. But you can sort of intuitively understand where these conformal transformations come from, because my choice of the radius of the matching surface was arbitrary.
All I did is I said it had to be in this intermediate regime. I could move it by 10 feet one direction or the other and still keep it in this matching regime. So that means that the physics has to be invariant under scale transformations of this matching surface. You can't
scale it arbitrarily. But in the limit where you probe it with very low frequency modes, you can. But you have to define that limit rather carefully.
You're just saying it's a low energy effective theory, which is conformal. But it's cut off at some scale.
At fixed omega, it's cut off at some scale.
Excuse me, why would you say that the physics was invariant rather than covariant?
That's covariant.
That simply means you can compensate changes, but it doesn't mean the physics is form invariant from their changing.
Well, let me describe exactly what I'll be a little more precise about exactly what I mean in a second.
This low energy limit is kind of confusing. I mean, you have a system that doesn't have the conformal symmetry, and then you say, all right, I'm going to take this low energy limit, then it'll have the conformal symmetry.
Right.
I mean, it's like you're scattering things off some sample in the lab, and you're upset because it doesn't have the rotational symmetry. So you just take a long wavelength limit, and only the S wave is left, and then everything organizes itself very nicely into representations of the rotational group.
That's not a bad analogy, because that also happens.
But it doesn't mean that the original thing has some deep... if you replace...
It means that there's a sector of the theory which has a conformal. Which has this.
That's right, but it doesn't mean that the microscopic degrees of freedom of your sample are described by something with rotational symmetry. It just means that if you replace some asymmetrical sample with a spherically symmetric thing of the right area, you'll reproduce certain...
Give the microscopic description first before you...
Why isn't it just like an RG flow to a conformal fixed point in the IR?
Because there's no fixed point.
I don't think so. Well, so far you just said that.
Let me make that claim, but let me make that claim precise. before, then we can decide.
I mean, you would expect an ABS region if there is a fixed point, right?
Yeah. So it's a little early in the morning, but nevertheless, I'm going to show you the Kerr metric. I'm not showing it to you because I really want you to pay too much attention to it. I'll just remind you of a few of its salient features.
So a Kerr black hole has a mass m and an angular momentum j. It has an inner and an outer horizon. The mass is given by the sum of the inner and outer horizon radii, and the angular momentum is given by their product. I'll be using Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. So r here is a radial coordinate. T and phi are coordinates that match onto the Minkowski time coordinate and a polar angle, an azimuthal angle out at infinity. The metric here is independent of T and phi, meaning that phi here is the axial symmetry coordinate of the Kerr black hole, whereas the angular coordinate theta is an angle off of the vertical axis on which the metric depends. So this is a Kerr black hole, which is some sort of oblate object. This is the theta coordinate, and the phi coordinate is the one which generates rotations around this axis. So let's now be a little more precise about considering physics in the Kerr background. So when I say I want to probe the Kerr black hole by a very low frequency mode, what I want to do is consider some field in the Kerr background. Because the metric was independent of T, I have a time translation symmetry, so I could consider some frequency basis. I could take phi to go like e to the I omega t times some function that doesn't depend on T, and then the statement that I'm probing with low energy modes means that I'm looking at the wave equation in the limit where the frequency is small compared to the scale set by the mass of the black hole. And the basic observation is that in the limit that I'm describing, in the near limit where the radius is close to the black hole as measured by the distance scale set by the frequency, the Kerr Laplacian actually takes a very special form. In fact, it takes the form of the quadratic Casimir of SL2R times SL2R. Let me make that statement a bit more precise. So first, I have the spherical part of the geometry, the theta and phi coordinates. Now, the Kerr metric is not spherically symmetric, but in the limit where I probe it by very low energy modes, that deviation from spherical symmetry disappears, and we just have a simple S2 Laplacian that appears in the Kerr Laplacian. The interesting part is the stuff that's left over, which involves the complicated radial dependence of the metric. And the observation is that I can find a set of three vectors, which is to say three diffeomorphisms in the geometry, that I'll call H0, H1, and H-1. These diffeomorphisms are not isometries of the Kerr metric, so they're not symmetries of the geometry. But nevertheless, if I write down the Kerr Laplacian, it's precisely the quadratic Casimir constructed out of these symmetries. So H0, H1, and H-1 are diffeomorphisms whose Lie brackets form the SL2R algebra, and the quadratic Casimir of that SL2R is the Laplacian. Moreover, I can find a second set of generators that I'll call H-bars, which also have the same quadratic Casimir that's given by the Kerr Laplacian. So what we see is that the wave equation in this limit, in fact, becomes invariant under SL2R times SL2R. Now, SL2R times SL2R is also known as SO2,2, which is the rigid conformal group in two dimensions. No. I'm considering... Oops. Okay. You'll have to wait one more slide. But in fact, this works for any field of arbitrary mass and spin. I'm considering free fields, though. The mass shifts. So, okay, take delta squared plus m squared. So the statement then is that states of the field theory will organize into representations of the conformal group. Which representations they are will depend on the mass of the spin. The same way that it works in ADS space. If you squint it hard enough, you could replace everything with ADS3 here, and you would almost get the right answer. Okay, let me be a little bit more specific about that. So the detailed form isn't too important, but I've written down here explicit expressions for the SL2R generators that I called H0, H1, and H-1. In the original Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, they take a rather complicated form. But what I've done here is I've chosen a different set of coordinates that I've called W plus and W minus, and then you can see that H0, H1, and H-1 take the usual form here for rigid conformal transformations on the plane defined by W plus and W minus. This is, if we were doing ADS3, I could have told you this 25 years ago, or Mark could have told you this 25 years ago. And of course, there are analogous expressions for the H bars, where I just replace pluses by minuses. So the conformal transformations that we talk about are really conformal transformations on the W plus W minus plane. And as I mentioned earlier, although the computation that I described for you before was only for a scalar field, in fact, it works for a field of any mass and spin, including the graviton. And moreover, not only can we write down diffeomorphisms corresponding to the rigid conformal generators, but you can also write down the very natural extension of this to the full infinite dimensional Virasoro algebra. You just do the sort of obvious thing by replacing W plus to some power, W plus to the 0, 1, or 2 power by W plus to the n. And the point is that these conformal transformations are not geometric in the sense that they're generated by diffeomorphisms, but those diffeomorphisms are not isometries. But nevertheless, all of the wave equations are invariant under these diffeomorphisms. So that means only in this very low energy, and only in the limit where I'm close to the black hole in the sense that I described it. So what that means is that the phase space of the theory can be organized, the states of the theory can be organized into representations of the conformal group. Now, when I say phase space of the theory, as Lenny pointed out, I don't mean the full phase space of the theory. I mean the part of the phase space that's defined by this near limit. Now, in the standard story for an extremal black hole, this would be a decoupling limit, and so I would expect there to be a conformal field theory describing the sector that's completely decoupled from the external physics. Now, the only difference is that I still have a conformal field theory, but I might expect it to be coupled to the physics far from the black hole in some way. But the point is that the states of the theory now just organize themselves into representations of the conformal group. And so the Hilbert space we expect to be the same as the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory. Now, all I need to do is describe that Hilbert space. That, of course, is easier said than done, but it turns out that in order to at least compute the density of states of this conformal field theory, I only need to know two important pieces of information. I need to know which states in the conformal field theory describe the black hole, and I only need to know one property of the conformal field theory, which is its central charge. And I need to make, I won't assume that it's unitary. I'll tell you exactly what I'm assuming. So in order to determine what state is described by these Kerr black holes, I need to admit that I actually lied to you about 10 minutes ago. So when I said that the Kerr Laplacian can be obtained as the quadratic Casimir of a set of diffeomorphisms, in fact, the diffeomorphisms that I was defining were not defined globally on the Kerr geometry, but only locally. In particular, if you look back at this expression for W plus and W minus, you'll see that I've exponentiated a constant T, T right or T left, times the angle phi. Now, the Kerr geometry has a periodically identified phi coordinate. So these W pluses and W minuses are not globally defined. They're only locally defined. And so in particular, the phi identified with phi plus 2 pi identifications of the Kerr geometry tell us that we need to identify these CF coordinates on which the conformal transformations act. So we now are imagining a CFT that lives on the W plus W minus plane, except we are instructed by the fact that we're living in the Kerr background to perform some set of identifications. And what are those identifications? Those are the identifications that put the conformal field theory at finite temperature. And the temperatures are just found by reading off these numbers, TR and TL, T right and T left, that went in to my definition of the W plus and W minus coordinate. And here I've written down the explicit expressions for the right moving and left moving temperatures. You can see that they're dimensionless, and I've written them in terms of the in terms of the outer and inner horizon radii. Yeah. Here. Yes. 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 So what does that mean? That means that we still have a conformal theory, but the state that we're considering is not conformally invariant. That's fine. In a conformal field theory, for example, the vacuum state might be conformally invariant, but if you're talking about some highly excited state, then it won't be conformally invariant. There's no imaginary time. It's thermal in the sense that if I start with the vacuum state in the W plus W minus plane, then by doing these identifications, I need to restrict myself to a strip on the W minus plane, which is the fundamental region of these identifications, and trace over things outside that strip. This is essentially the Maldesain-Astrominger stringy exclusion principle. Sorry. We can discuss it afterwards if you are unhappy with that.
W plus is periodically identified, and that gives you a temperature in the for the plus.
Yeah, we need no, but Lenny's right. I mean, I'm working in Lorentzian signature here, not Euclidean signature. I could go to if I went to Euclidean signature, I would get the same answer in the same way that in Riddler's. Well, okay, look. I think I'm not going to Euclidean time here. I'm just talking about this is essentially. Says that the W plus and W minus coordinates are Rindler coordinates on the CFT, not Minkowski coordinates. And so they're at finite temperature. And because they're at finite temperature, the state that describes the Kerr black hole is not conformally invariant, but it's only invariant under a U1 times U1 subset of that conformal symmetry.
So that's the state.
There's a right moving and a left moving temperature. Or if you wanted to, you could say there's a temperature and an angular potential. And so this is just the statement that if you look at a state at finite temperature and angular potential, it'll be invariant under time translation and rotation, but not under the full conformal symmetry. I mean, we have rotating black holes, so we should expect angular potentials in addition to temperature. This is just the temperature, you know, at this point, this is the temperature of the state in the conformal field theory that is describing the Kerr black hole.
Your low energies.
Well, I've taken a low energy limit, and then I have a conformal symmetry in that limit, I mean, I'm probing the black hole by low energy modes. I'm discovering a conformal symmetry of
that sector of the theory. And then I'm describing my black hole as a state in that sector of the theory. And this is the sector that describes physics near the black hole. So
maybe I can continue.
Okay. Now, we've discovered that our black hole is a finite temperature state in the theory. So now I need to tell you a little bit about the conformal field theory. Well, in order to compute the central charge of the conformal field theory, I need to find a state which is invariant under some of the conformal symmetries. And indeed, if I set T right equals to zero, then the SL2R right transformations will not be broken by the geometry. In particular, if you go back to the definition of W plus, you see that if T right is equal to zero, then W plus doesn't change when I take pi to pi plus 2 pi. So all of the right-moving conformal transformations are unbroken. And indeed, if you look at this formula for T right is equal to zero when R plus is equal to R minus, which is the statement that we have an extremely rotating black hole. And now we're in business. Because for an extremely rotating black hole, these SL2R right symmetries are geometrically realized, and I can go ahead and compute the central charge using the techniques that were pioneered by Brown and Minow. And this, so in particular, if we look at this extremely rotating black hole, then we have a nice geometric near horizon limit, which has a conformal symmetry. In particular, there's a full infinite dimensional algebra of Virasoro diffeomorphisms, whose algebra is given by the Virasoro algebra. I can then compute the algebra of charges which generate those diffeomorphisms and see that it acquires a central extension. And the central charge can be computed, and it's just equal to the angular momentum of the black hole. And in fact, this is the computation that was done by Guica, Hartmann, Song, and Strominger when they used this to describe the microstates of extremely rotating for a black hole. So what we're now seeing is that the CFT that we're investigating is the same CFT used by these authors to describe extremal black holes, but we're now putting it at finite temperature in order to describe a non-extremal black hole. So at this point now, in order to describe the density of states in the CFT, we need to make some assumptions, and I'll make what I think are three physically motivated but not rigorously proven assumptions about the properties of the CFT. So first of all, I only computed the right-moving central charge for you. I don't have an analogous computation of the left-moving central charge because, as far as I know, there's no geometry which is invariant under the SL2R left. So instead, what I need to do is just assume that my conformal field theory is parity invariant, so that the left and right moving central charges are equal. And this I regard as probably the most important assumption that I'm making, and the one about which one could certainly argue. But if we just proceed by assuming that the CFT is parity invariant, then it's very easy to go ahead and compute the asymptotic density of states. So in order to do so, we need to assume that the theory, the CFT, is invariant not just under infinitesimal conformal transformations, but under finite conformal transformations, which means that the theory is modular invariant. And moreover, I need to assume that the theory has a normalizable Brown state. And Cardy showed that under those circumstances, you can write down a formula for the asymptotic density of states. The basic idea is that invariance under large conformal transformations relates the properties of the vacuum of the theory to properties of the asymptotic density of states.
No. Well, I'm using Cardy's formula to derive the density of states in the UV.
But your vacuum surface is at a finite scale.
Yes. But the This is the UV, yes. This UV doesn't live, I don't think it's fair to say that this UV lives in part of the Kerr geometry.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just looking again whether the temperature scale is above or below or at the same scale as the matching the surface.
Let me get to that in a second. We need to be careful when we say what we need to be very careful about what we mean by temperature when we say that. So before getting to that, let me first just ask under what circumstances Carty's formula is a good approximation to the density of states in CMT. So Carty's formula is something that describes the density of states at very high energy. Many of you are probably more used to seeing Carty's formula in microcanonical ensemble, where it's the number of states as a function of energy. Here I've written it down in canonical ensemble, where it's the number of states as a function of temperature. And it's a good approximation for high energy states, which is to say states at very large temperature. And in fact, if you look at the expressions for T left and T right that I wrote down, they become large when the mass of the black hole is large. So that actually is a rather strange statement to make, because if you think about the Hawking temperature of the Kerr black hole, that goes to zero when the mass of the black hole is large. And the important point here is that T right and T left are not the usual Hawking temperature and angular potential. The Hawking temperature and angular potential are the thermodynamic potentials related to the Hamiltonian, which generates time translation out at infinity. Whereas T left and T right are the thermodynamic potentials that are that are conjugate to the generators of translation in W plus and W minus.
Is the Hawking temperature related as a harmonic mean of T left and T right?
No, it's not. Yes.
So what are the corrections to this if TL and TR are not large?
Well, the first correction, well, so there's different classes of corrections. The first correction is the sort of universal logarithmic correction. That's the thing that comes because you go between canonical and microcanonical ensemble. That's a sort of trivial correction. But in order to understand the further subleading corrections, you need to understand not just the vacuum state of the CFT, but you need to understand the spectrum of excited states. So for example, the first correction is exponentially suppressed, but the amount of suppression depends on the dimension of the lowest non-trivial operator in the CFT. So we would need to know about the spectrum of primaries in the CFT in order to write down subleading corrections. They're exponentially suppressed. That's the crucial, that's the statement about the normalizable. That's an assumption that I'm making at this point. But the reason I make that assumption is that it gives me an answer that is very interesting. In particular, if I take the log of this number and interpret that as an entropy, I get precisely the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So the asymptotic density of states of this theory is exactly what you would expect for a Kerr black hole. And I get the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, including the precise numerical coefficient. Absolutely not. That, I think, is the interesting and important, thank you, question. So I'm really at the end of the story that I wanted to tell today. Let me just make a few more comments. First of all, one can try and come up with additional evidence that non-extremal black holes are described by states in the conformal field theory. So for example, you can calculate scattering amplitudes and show that they reproduce CFT correlation functions. One can also try and apply this prescription to various other sorts of non-extremal black holes. And there have been several discussions of this in the literature. But at this point, I think that this putative CFT, which describes the states of a Kerr black hole, is still a bit of a mysterious object. So maybe I should just end with a few conclusions. So we're closing in on a microscopic description of the quantum states of realistic black holes. And using holographic techniques, one can argue that such states can be described as the states of a conformal field theory, the salient point being that the conformal transformations are not geometric, but instead are just symmetries that act on the phase space of a certain sector of the theory. And this reproduces the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, including a precise numerical coefficient, provided one makes a certain set of physical assumptions about the conformal field theory.
But as Eva pointed out, this is not a string theory construction. And so unlike in ADS-CFT, I don't know anything about the dual CFT aside from what I can compute from the gravity point of view. In particular, I don't even know the vacuum state of the theory. I showed you the right-moving vacuum state of the theory, but the full vacuum state, which is invariant under SL2R left, I think is much more mysterious. So, for example, there are all sorts of interesting questions which this picture does not address. In particular, what are the microstates? How should we think about them? And can we think about them geometrically? So my guess is that the microstates are not geometric. In fact, I have an additional 8 slides explaining why I think that is the case. But in view of the time, I will be kind and I will not go through them. So you'll have to invite me back to show you those slides. Okay, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
How do you interpret your temperature, these two temperatures? Are they like conventional in a thermodynamic sense? Or?
They're conventional in a thermodynamic sense, absolutely. The only difference is that they're not the temperatures conjugate to the usual Hamilton generic. You know, usually we talk about a temperature and angular potential, which are the potentials conjugate to the Hamiltonian and the angular momentum as defined at asymptotic infinity. But these are not. These are defined as conjugate to the field theory generators. That if they live anywhere, live on the matching surface.
And what would be interpretation? Because we have two temperatures. Why are they distinct?
Oh, they're distinct because the black hole is rotating. So usually, you know, this is the standard for the Kerr black hole. Not only do you have a temperature, you also have an angular potential. So if you want to, you can organize that into a left and a right moving temperature. One is associated with T plus phi, and one with T minus phi. That's not special to my picture. That's just a statement that not only am I in canonical ensemble, I'm in grand canonical ensemble. That's the way it's saying. Where by grand canonical ensemble, I mean I'm introducing a potential associated with angular momentum. So that is not special to what I'm saying. Yeah.
So this is just the long wavelength limit, the states in that limit. But of course, there are many microstates you expect sort of a shorter wavelengths. What would you say about that?
Well,
you know, you might expect a lot of the microstates to be in that.
My point of view, my guess is that this CFT is something that really exists, but that we can only access if we probe the black hole by very long wavelength excitation. Very low, I should be careful, not long wavelength, but low energy excitations.
Yeah, but what if we probe it with higher frequencies?
Well, I think my gut feeling is that the CFT interacts with stuff out at infinity. And if you probe it with a very high energy excitation, you'll hit the CFT really hard, and this conformal symmetry will not be obvious. That's the physics picture that I think.
There's a simple system which is described by two CFTs, which has the same entropy, which is two extremal Kerr black holes, far apart from each other. How do you know that you're not describing that system? It has the same C times T for each side.
It has more symmetry, though. Well, yeah.
I think that might be why various numbers are working out correctly.
I don't see why you think, okay, I mean, that the system you described has more symmetry than the system I'm describing.
That's true. But it has the same entropy, which is what we're computing.
A lot of things have the same entropy. I mean, you want to say that, okay, you didn't have to say a lot of systems have the same entropy, okay? So.
But I think it's the thing that's described by these two non-interacting CFTs, which are not coupled to anything.
I don't know why, I don't see why you say they're non-interacting.
The computation you had two CFTs that were not interacting with each other.
No, I had one CFT with a left and a right moving central charge. I mean, one CFT has a left and a right. One CFT does not equal the product of two chiral CFTs. It's only very, very special CFTs for which that's true, and I see no evidence that that's true for this CFT.
All right, well.
Okay, I think this is important. I mean, a general CFT is not the same as the product, does not holomorphically factorize. The correlation functions don't holomorphically factorize. I see no evidence, for example, that the correlation functions in the CFT holomorphically factorize. In some sense, it would be much less interesting. Well, okay.
it would be interesting. It would be much. It would be different if that were the case. Gary, did you have a?
Two quick things. So first of all, in response to Steve's comment, is it possible that you're getting the entropy because, in some sense, you get more states if you build up everything from very low energy excitations, and the high energy states would contribute some sublinear correction to the entropy?
That seems possible. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think it's the case that I'm building up the black hole for low energy stuff. I think I'm probing the black hole with low energy stuff.
This is the entropy of a black hole, not the entropy of a probe.
Absolutely.
Right, so you have to somehow be getting the whole black hole.
I'm probing the black hole with something at very low energy, but I'm not computing the entropy of the probe. I'm using the probe to derive the existence of a conformal symmetry. Then I'm using that conformal symmetry to derive an entropy. So for example, you could look at I could have made the exact same argument for a scalar field in ADS3. But I would not say that the density of states of a scalar field in ADS3 goes in accord with grows in accord with Hardy's formula. Yeah.
Well, just one follow-up comment to that. I think, at least in the usual semi-classical picture, in thinking about, say, the Hawking radiation, in some sense, the entropy is in modes that are at scales with wavelengths close to the radius of the horizon.
That's why I'm very careful to say I'm not looking at long wavelength modes. I'm looking at low energy. But yes, I understand what you're saying. Well, I mean, there's a simple set of higher derivative terms that I could talk about. Well, okay. Higher derivative terms, in the Brown and Ono computation, the higher derivative terms change the central charge of the theory. And as far as I know, in that context, you can incorporate a hell of a lot just by changing, renormalizing the central charge for the theory. Basically, those higher derivative terms normalize the radius of ADS. Whether or not one could tell the same story here is a good question. My suspicion is the answer is probably. I think I have some negative 10 minutes left. So you're going
to
tell
I think we have to move forward. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank Alex again. And so next is Jonathan Heckman.